I think this episode, Fuji stole my heart. Her side eye and tea sips in this scene had me rolling on the floor.
Okay.
That like Lady Jin observing like, oh, the engine's never not in your presence. And like Fuji just like takes that stuff with her with the cup with the big eyes and like just sip. I'm just sipping my tea. Just sipping my tea here.
Yeah.
She's really stealing all the scenes, man.
Welcome to Bald New Prestige, the officially unofficial podcast for Shogun on Hulu. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking episode 6, Ladies of the Willow World. Aaron, how are you feeling about this episode?
I love this episode. Banger after banger. I keep waiting for this show to have like a catch your breath episode. And maybe this was it, but
yeah, this is it.
So much happening. It's so impactful. I remember just coincidentally, we watched Blue Eyed Samurai and we talked quite a bit about it on our premium podcast, Off the Clock. And one of you and I's favorite episodes was the one that entirely takes place within like this Japanese play, these no's. And what an artistic way to tell a story it was. And I was delighted to see Shogun spend a quarter of its runtime this week on a similar kind of setup where we get to know the Lady Ochiba and Mariko's past, and they give us a little bit more, you know, background on the Taiko, and we get a little bit more insights in Ishido and you know, his status in the realm and what people think about him. And it's just, it's such an entertaining way to find out about people, you know. This show continues to just excel at just letting you know, just presenting things to you and letting you draw your own conclusions. I thought the character moments between Mariko and Blackthorn in the Willow World were excellent. And it looks like we're very close to an all-out war. You know, Jozen didn't do it, but this latest outrage perpetrated by those damn bandits. Those damn bandits in the countryside.
Those bandits are everywhere. Just filling the countryside.
Really an understated political force in medieval Japan, apparently.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And I got to see the Iron Fist some dudes. I've been waiting for this guy to the uncork and him cutting himself out of Osaka Castle, riding the dude down, slicing up guys. I thought that was super cool too. I continued to be completely in the tank for this show. It's one of the best things I've seen since like Severance in terms of just like grabbing a hold of me. And, this is how in the tank I am. I have to get up at like 6:30 each morning to make sure my son gets to school. This show drops at midnight on like Tuesday. I couldn't sleep. It's 12:05. I'm like, fuck it. I'm watching Shogun. That, you know, I'm losing sleep for this show. What do you think?
No, I'm with you. It's one of the season's more subtle episodes. You know, there's not an earthquake or landslide that happens. There isn't a boat race. There's nothing like super exciting on the face of it, but it's all of the character work they're doing and all of the politics that are starting to really come to fruition here that excite me about it. I'm also in the tank for this show. It's easily the best thing going right now, so glad we're covering it.
And it's like, you know, some of it's like, you know, it's not super exciting, but a lot of stuff happens. Like Sugiyama, which has previously been established as one of the oldest, wealthiest samurai families in Japan, a great Japanese house, wiped out to the man. But it all happens off screen. So you just see the political. So it's this show's so confident that, you know, they can just skip the action because they know the drama and the political intrigue is so good. You don't need to see the schnick and schnack and the dodge and parry to really get gripped up in it.
Yeah, and I like the way that they've built up Ochiba this episode. I thought, you know, last episode ending with that moment where she comes in and says the council is mine, the time for politics is over. You know, it could have been exciting if I knew more about her. Well, now I do. And I see both what kind of person she is, but also why she is that way. Like you mentioned, all these flashbacks tell us so much more about her relationship with Mariko and Toranaga, and it's, yeah, it's interesting because I don't know how much of that, how much of her perception of Toranaga I should take at face value here. But it's an open question. The one, it's one that the show has kept open this entire time, and I think that's kind of important as we go along. I need to not be totally sure that I'm on Toranaga's side for this to be super interesting, right?
Yeah, and you know, we still haven't gotten through any of the fences, seen any of his inner heart, and yeah, we see Lady Ochiba confidently predict that she knows it, and I can see it. I can see it either way.
I don't know if she's right, but I also don't know that she's wrong. So,
right.
It'll be interesting as we move along here to see how that shakes out.
Anything else do we want? I mean, this is, you know, in addition to being a very subtle episode, it continues to be a beautiful episode. Particularly the scenes in the tea house and the surrounding gardens, just like some of the interstitial stuff where when they transition from like, I love when they transition from like Osaka to the fishing village. Ajiru, right. They always kind of like have these like mist-shrouded garden posts and, you know, just little details of the house. And it just really, you know, you can tell immediately where you're at just by the architecture and the scope of things and like how misty and wet things are.
Or sometimes they show you the decimated army, right? The encampment. That really helps, but it helps to remind us, oh yeah, they've just suffered a devastating attack from Mother Nature.
And the just constant threats from within, from without, from the environment itself. An ever-shifting ground underneath your feet, literally. What a great setting, and what a great story. We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause. And now, back with more Bald Move. Shall we get into the story of this week?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, we start the show with a flashback to Mariko's past, as she meets Lady Ochiba for the first time as young girls.
Yeah, here's where my confusion starts with the episode. Because I was a little bit confused.
Right on the first scene.
On.
It's a struggle.
Some of these flashbacks, because they don't give you any real information about who these people are. They kind of expect you to pick it up on context clues. And I did. You know, watch through, it's like, okay, this is her father, and this is the Taiko, and this is like,
yes,
yeah, pretty obvious. But the situation here was interesting because they spend all this time here in Osaka, and I was not sure if Mariko and her father were living here full time, or if they were on a long visit, or, you know, they would visit and then they would return to their land and then they would come back here every so often. That wasn't super clear to me. I don't know what the arrangement is with these lords, with these vassal lords.
It seems like, and again, this is just my surmisal because I haven't actually read much into this, but there's a similar thing to, like, if you're familiar with Game of Thrones, the fact that the different houses would send their children off to other houses for, like, finishing school, essentially. Mm-hmm. Like, hey, get out of our home, go get some hard knocks, learn the finer points of swordsmanship or courtly behavior. And sometimes those relationships are kind of a hostage type deal to keep the lords in line as well.
Oh yeah, I've played Crusader Kings 3. I know all about that.
Yeah, it seems like the warlord, this Kuroda guy, had a daughter who was lonely, and he asked one of his vassals, Mariko's dad, "Hey, you got a young girl? Why don't you bring her over?" So Ochiba, or I guess Reina, was her first before she got rechristened.
Ruri, which is impossible to say without.
I'm so fucked, dude, because I just
you
did
have
a
to
whole
say
bunch
Duri,
of research.
Which is yeah.
Plus, I did a whole bunch of research on the House of the Dragon stuff for our preview podcast today. So I went to Reina.
Yeah, nope.
That's a Targaryen name. That's not Japanese.
No,
Ruri. Nope. Keep the girls company, and we also see some of the friction between Toranaga and Mariko's dad and this Kuroda.
Yeah.
He's At first, I thought these were Portuguese Christians, Christian converts. But apparently, these are like Shaolin monks or some kind of warrior monk monastery that he's just wiping out for some kind of rumor of disloyalty or the fact that they're not bending the knee, and it's killing all this holy men is really upsetting the men.
Yeah, especially Mariko's father, right? He's the guy who kind of wants to rush in here and stop this or maybe even kill the guy. I don't know. But it kind of, connects some dots with Torunaga and his dislike of the Christians here, or at least resistance to having them in his particular lands. And that lends a little bit of credence to, well, maybe, if he sees the lords here putting to the sword a bunch of monks, maybe because they kind of have fallen under this way of Christianity and he doesn't like that, he might conspire with Mariko's father, whose name I cannot remember, Jinsai or something. He might conspire with him to kill the people in charge of that. So it throws into question, like, kind of whether or not Torunaga is truly a good guy here. Yeah. Whether he is defending what he sees as Japan and doing the righteous and honorable thing here by his people, or if he is, power mad, right?
Yeah, I had a slightly different interpretation of the scene. I didn't take it as like these were Christian converts and Coronado's killing. I took it as more of these were, that these guys just weren't toeing the line, and that, like, you think about, this is probably right before or right simultaneously as the Portuguese are arriving. Mm-hmm. Imagine if, like, all the bishops in the United States, Catholic bishops, were executed by the president, and then, Shinto missionaries roll in the week later, and, like, you've got this, like, power vacuum of religion that's been wiped out, and now you've got these foreigners kind of, and I think Torunaga's, like, grudge against the Christians is more of that kind of thing, like, hell, we massacred my guys, and now these other guys are coming and getting a foothold and putting money and being kind of high and mighty about it. It's more of a political religious grudge than just
But it's also interesting that he doesn't really seem to concern himself that much with it. There are some scenes later with Mariko and Blackthorn that he almost seems oblivious to the nature of the Portuguese relationship with Japan, right? Like the true nature of it, the profiteering, that kind of thing.
And the heart he wears on his sleeve seems to be ignorant of it, for sure.
Yeah, it's an open question about this guy, but like that on the face of it, that's the reading of it. So,
but recall the Catholics, like, what a boner they got when Torunaga said, "I'll allow a church in Edo." Like, I think he is a pretty staunch anti-Christian. Like, his entire province has been a no-fly zone for Christianity, so him softening in that was so.
That's what I mean. There's a lot of confusion around that as to, like, what is his true feelings on this, and I think that's partially intentional by him, and partially just, the show wants to keep us in suspense.
And how much of it is like a spiritual, philosophical difference, and how much of it is just politics? I thought it was a really great, because, like, we see that Lady Ochiva, I think, has grown to hate Mariko for her father's actions and Torunaga by extension. But in this scene where Mariko comes out to see these monks being slaughtered, her father sends her to bed. And when she goes back to bed, her and Ochiba are back to back, but they, like, little girls kind of snuggle together so that they're touching. I thought that was
cute. They really had a friendship here. And they bonded in their early life, but somewhere along the line, when she had to leave, she was married off to Bintaro, they lost touch, and now she's a changed person. Mariko doesn't even recognize this woman.
Yeah, let's get to that. So we see an older Mariko. Seems like 10 years have gone by. She's an elder teen, early 20s. She's working on her Naginata skills, the Japanese pole arm, and is also appalled at the marriage alliance that her father has set, that she sees as beneath her family and herself.
Yeah, because Bintaro is...
BT dubs, it's Bintaro she's talking about.
Yeah, Bintaro is not a from a respected house, you know. It's not an alliance of any value is the way that she sort of frames it. And
yeah, I don't think it's like from a respected house. It's just a minor house. Like what does this get us?
And they're out of the way and they're not in the limelight. And yeah, she's the thing that she doesn't understand here is why her father would marry. It feels to her like this marriage is a waste of their political capital, you know. She could be married off to someone much more powerful, someone much closer to the Taiko or the Shogun or whoever is in power at this point.
Sure.
But her father's marrying off to this guy? Why? And yeah, it will make sense later in the episode.
You see Bintaro like eyeing her as she's going about her exercises, and she seems to catch his eye. He's all for it. I also thought it's interesting how Achiva is kind of like, you know, trying to buck her up, like, you know, hey, we are so privileged. We have such good lives. Why should we concern ourselves with things we can't control? And that seems to soften up Mariko. And there's also an interesting scene where her father, Jinsei, I think this is something he is internal monologuing, because by the end of the episode, we find out that Mariko didn't know this, but he's saying, you know, you're my ever obedient daughter and you've done everything I've asked you for. And now I ask for something greater. Your duty is going to be the thing that endures, as she's loaded into what I think is a honeymoon litter. She's in his white dress. She's being shipped off to be married.
I assume so. There are two options there. It could be an internal monologue. It could also be that she just doesn't understand the full meaning of that statement, right? Like her duty she thinks is just to marry the guy that her father tells her to marry and not question it. But her duty is actually going to be something much more enduring, like it says.
And that's the thing. I'm very curious to see like what part of this war her father expected her to play. But it's also another tragedy, because here's Bontero and her, like, they're both suffering under these false illusions, and it's turned their marriage into this hideous prison. Yeah. Neither one of them can escape, and they're just getting more and more bitter about it. So, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I appreciated all those extra notes about the character. We then join in the present day. Toranaga at night is kind of doing a mass funeral. What do you call that? Eulogy for the people who've died, but also trying to boost their morale after this devastating earthquake. Then he smoothly transitions to richly rewarding the Anjin for saving his life once more. Starting to ruffle. Well, it's not starting. It's continuing to ruffle the feathers of some of his other more accomplished samurai, it seems, including his son.
Including Omi. Yeah, Omi just can't get over this, man. He's like, I had the cannons. We had the cannons. Yeah. And he took the cannons away and gave them to this loser. I liked the speech here from Toranaga about death being an affirmation of life.
Yeah,
because it's kind of proof, like, you can't die without having lived. It's kind of proof that you were here, you know. It's something interesting
and an affirmation of it, like, it's an interesting way to look at death, that like every time death is a reminder to live life, you know, because you know you've got it now, you don't know when it's going to be over. So some of these Eastern philosophies are pretty compelling, I think.
Yeah, I have no idea if this is an Eastern philosophy or a Toranaga original, but I like it.
I tell you what, I never heard this at a Christian funeral.
That's true.
Death being the affirmation of life, but
certainly not in those terms. Here's the interesting thing about giving Blackthorn this reward to me.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like Toranaga is trying to trying to invest him in Japan here, right? Like giving him a fief, giving him the 600 koku. He's like telling him, stay here. You now have land. You now have, like, trying to get him to stay. And I don't. Yeah. I don't. I'm kind of with Omi here. I don't quite understand what he sees in Blackthorn.
Yeah. There's got to be something to the Admiralty. You know, we saw how much stronger, like, these European boats at the time were in terms of resisting boarding and how much better their cannon are. There's got to be something that he sees, some advantage to that, you know?
Yeah.
And it might short, but weakness, like, We find out later Lord Toranaga's never lost a battle, but how many sea battles has he fought? How many sea battles have any of these Japanese fought? So I was like, that's where, you know, again, I'm just speculating, but that's kind of where my mind goes. But, and I think he's trying to wed him to Japan because, like, at this point, I'm like, God damn, Black, why do you want to go back? You got, you're the landed gentry now. You've got like 1,000 cuckoos that you can spend each year. Like, what,
and
why,
if you can survive the coming war? Yeah.
Like, do you think you could do better going back to, but maybe he can, maybe he's worth 1,000 acres and a baronetcy for this in England. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, what are the Dutch going to think when he comes back empty handed? With four fewer ships, right? And hardly any crew.
And like, yeah, like missing 500 dudes. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. It's really interesting to me what he's trying to do here, because I don't quite see through it.
I'll tell you what.
I do wonder if the ships are not as, the ships of the Japanese are not nearly as powerful as I think they are, or as numerous. Like, can one Dutch ship here make a difference in a sea war with all these cannons?
It's hard to say, because the other thing about the, because I as soon as I said it, I immediately, the apparent superiority of these European ships compared to Japanese, it seems like that's in case of being boarded. But to be fair, none of those Japanese who were all Christian were willing to fire on the other Christian ship, so they obviously have advantages in terms of like interdiction and boarding them. But in terms of like cannon versus cannon, or if you get like flaming arrows involved, I really don't know. That's a good question. I don't have a good handle on what the Japanese fleet was.
Well, the show also might be playing fast with it, because like the Black Ship being the singular trade ship for the Portuguese in Japan seems a little far-fetched.
Mm-hmm.
But the show kind of is leaning into that concept. So maybe they're also leaning into the concept of a single Dutch ship here with all these cannons could make a huge difference.
Yeah, yeah. I do think that the English, the European ships are faster. They definitely can sail longer distances. And it's not like a technology thing. It's more of a cultural thing, because like most of the Asia went into extreme isolation mode after they got invaded by the Mongolian, the Huns, the Mongols, Genghis Khan and his thing. So like they probably could have built ships if they wanted to do their age of exploration, but they just didn't want to, because you know, you meet scary people out there. We're the center of the world right here. We got everything we need. Why go out and look for things? Let people bring it to us. I tell you what though, I won't learn one from this scene. Lord Toranaga says, hi, you say, ho, because I like that. I like that call and response.
Uh-huh.
Get you pumped. So while the village is cleaning and repairing from the natural disaster, Yabashiga bitterly complains to his nephew, Omi, about the impossible positions they continually find themselves in.
I did start to question, what's the point of giving the cannons to Omi and by proxy Yabashige, if they're just going to take them away in the next episode? Why even bother with that? I guess it serves to piss them off. Although Yabashige doesn't seem pissed off. He seems resigned to it, and just like, you know, his usual kind of, what can I do sort of self. And then Omi's the one who seems pissed off.
Well, because he already had the shit taken from him last episode, despite his words to contrary. And so he's over it. But Omi, the wound is fresh. Like, I thought I was going to be the cannon commander. And obviously, he's looking for a way to distinguish himself in front of Lord Toranaga. Looks like he's getting the opportunities.
Yeah, and the scary thing, I guess, about this is that he seems to be an independent actor here, as far as he's not going to ask Yabashige if he should do something before he just acts. He's pretty rash in his acts, right? I mean, inciting, what is Toranaga's son's name?
Nagakato, I think.
Nagakata, yeah. It's sort of inciting him to kill Jozen last episode was definitely, you know, pretty intense move. And Yabashige didn't sanction it, so yeah.
I disagree. I think that was all a worked shoot. I just wanted to get that contrasting opinion in there. Oh, it was all over Yabu's face. You could read him like the New York Times, man.
No, Yabu doesn't know anything.
Two key things in this scene. They also give us we're wondering what the scale of the devastation, how much of Torunaga's army. Yabushiga says thousands are dead. Probably some villagers, some soldiers, but that's a big fucking number. We see at the end of the episode, the Torunaga still got a pretty large host, but yeah, that's a lot. Yabu writes another will. Yeah,
he must do this every week. This guy,
just when he feels his neck, when he can start to feel a slice on his neck, it's time for a new will.
Yeah,
very brief scene, but very oddly spiritually romantic scene of Blackthorn and Mariko sharing a prayer in their home.
Yeah, they're sharing it. I think some of it's consensual and some of it isn't, like, because Mariko starts out praying and then you get these paper walls where everybody can hear what you're doing. Sure. And so Blackthorn hears her and sits down across just outside the wall. She could probably see his shadow, honestly.
Oh yeah.
But she could definitely 100%. Hear as he prays in Portuguese, I guess, through this wall right next to her. This feels like there's something very rude about this prayer. Like, Blackthorn is trying to force her into, like, this is sharing words, which is what she said she wasn't going to do, in a weird, like, spiritual context. I don't know. It felt very invasive.
Really?
I didn't like it. Yeah. Because she didn't sit down and say, oh, I hope Blackthorn will come over here and pray with me. She had told him, we will never share words, and he's sitting down here sharing a prayer with her. It's an intimate setting, and
they're sharing other people's words. She's just quoting Christ here, you know, the Lord's
Prayer.
Sure,
sure, but they're saying the same words.
In Latin.
It felt very, I don't know, intimate and, like I said, invasive on Blackthorn's part.
Well, I disagree with that take, but I do think that they are showing a little bit of the division still between them, because something you might not know, the Lord's Prayer is slightly different in Catholicism versus Protestantism.
Oh, really?
I actually learned this in the Master and Commander movie. But, like, Protestants add, for thine is the kingdom, the power, the glory forever and ever, after deliver us from evil. Whereas in, I guess, Catholics, they're accustomed to pausing and letting the priest say a prayer and then finishing that for them. So most Catholics stop at the deliver us from evil, whereas and you see Mariko do that. Like, there's
call
a significant pause.
Prayer.
Well, isn't that a Lutheran thing? No, I don't know. You'd have to ask a Catholic. I've never been to a Catholic service, but that's just what I understood. And from my own personal knowledge and doing a little bit of reading, that there's a difference there. And it's all, like, about, like, when the Bible got officially entered in the canon and a scribal error and a difference in translation and the fact that the priest leads versus. But it's a big cultural difference. And I think the point is there, again, show not tell. They're illustrating that even the Lord's Prayer between them is different. Different language, different faith, you know.
Makes sense.
The next morning, Buntaro apologizes to Lord Torunaga, who then meets with Blackthorn, who once again requests access to his ship, his men, and leave to prosecute the war against the Catholic Portuguese in Lord Torunaga's name.
Why is Torunaga tormenting Buntaro?
I don't think he's tormenting him.
I know, but that's the effect it's going to have. I mean, can you imagine? Like, you're told, okay, isolate yourself from your wife for 7 days.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, just imagine what's going through his head for those 7 days, knowing that Mariko and Blackthorn have some weird connection, and now they're alone together for the 7 days while you are isolated.
I'm not sure how much Lord Torunaga actually knows, how much he suspects, how much he's.
I don't know if there's.
If
an
you think that Lord Torunaga
it
knows,
is torture.
This is some wild behavior to treat one of your favorite samurai.
Right.
Like, hey, go take a 7 day powder. Also, Anjan and Mariko are going to be hanging out. In fact, I'm going to send him to a whorehouse.
And they walk up right behind you in this scene as you turn around.
I almost feel sorry for this guy. If he had to pop Mariko last episode, I would have feel sorry.
Sure,
but, like,
yeah.
right as you get in, you're seeing yourself just prostrate and abased before your lord, and you've just been banished essentially for 7 days, and then this fucker swaggers up with your wife in tow. And you gotta bow to him? Because what are you gonna do? Start some shit right after your... Because, like, Tornaga's pretty tough with him. He's like, you know, she's like, this wife of mine, you know... We've had it's always been rocky since her old man murdered that dude, and I keep telling her she can't kill herself, and she's just been this ice queen, but with the barbarian it's different. And Toranaga's like, look, I told Mariko to do her duty, and she's doing it, which is more than I can say for you. Like, he's, you know, I think he's a misstep or two away from some seppuku action.
Yeah, I almost expected him to offer it in this scene.
Yeah, and again, like, you know, if you didn't believe the producers on the official podcast last week about Buntaro actually loving Mariko, I think that comes through that he is. Mm-hmm. It's a tragic situation that he loves this woman. You know, something happened beyond either of their controls that set them. You know, he's trying to keep her from killing herself. She is resentful that he won't let her kill herself. And since she can't do that, she's bending all the rest of her conscious will into making his life hell. It's, like Tornaga said, you should get a divorce. And he's like, I just can't after all these years. Like, I've sunk cost fallacy, illustrated.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting to see how ice cold to have Buntaro describe the ice cold nature of Mariko in their relationship. How she's just never thawed to him, and how in this same scene we're going to see what that means now with Blackthorn as well. Although I think it's slightly different because Mariko doesn't take shots at Buntaro the way she does at Blackthorn here, because there is some kind of like emotional connection there. And she feels hurt by Blackthorn, whereas she doesn't feel hurt by Buntaro. She just doesn't want to be there. But it's a nice way to say, okay, here's what the ice cold treatment looks like with Mariko.
And it's also like, I think it puts into context earlier scenes where Buntaro seemed like just a fucking asshole, where like Mariko and her son are having a cute moment talking about the barbarian or kind of giggling. And then he comes in and just ice wall. It's like, that must be maddening to know that she's not like this with everyone. Yeah, you know, she actually is a very warm, engaging, intelligent personality. It's just me. It's just me. And the only thing I've done is keep her from killing herself. Like, it's got to be, again, it doesn't excuse this fucking behavior. Everyone's accountable for their own actions. But it goes a long way to understanding why their relationship is like this.
Mm-hmm.
And it's then the tragedy, you get to the end of the episode and realize it's kind of for no damn good reason, too. But that's for a few more scenes later. We haven't really talked about the second part of this conversation, Blackthorn and Mariko. I thought the big notable thing, because this is just, you know, him talking to Toranaga declining his request, but the thing that jumped out of my mind is how Mariko is, after, you know, she said that she's just going to be his translator, but she's kind of refusing to translate. And even when she does translate, I could say she's giving the spirit of the Anjin's words, but I don't think she's being, I wouldn't call this leal behavior, you know, by House of the Dragon standards.
I found a lot of stuff in this episode where she was translating for him to be like, I don't know if she's giving the spirit of what he said, really. She's kind of filtering it through her own perception of what will play here or what she wants to communicate to the other party, as opposed to what he does. And
a lack of conviction, persuasiveness when, you know,
she's or information these that words. Is left out, maybe, or a tonality thing. I don't know. But yeah, I definitely felt it. And Toranaga sees, you know, this kind of sniping back and forth, this arguing. And I think it's now that he finally realizes, oh, there is something going on, right? And so it's extra... I think it's extra interesting when he sends them to the brothel together. He knows that this is... I don't think he would order this if he didn't know, right? I don't think he would order her to be there as his interpreter
I mean, this is like CIA Soviet espionage textbook. Like, dudes talk when they're pillowing with women. They like to boast. They like to brag. They like to puff themselves up and talk about, like, you know,
but he can't because she doesn't speak his language. The Kiku doesn't speak his language.
Yeah, but who knows what a man might say to a woman when he doesn't think she understands, you know, like in terms of, you know, just it's a time honored technique. Sure. No, I know that. But I'm saying, like, would an Englishman be more or less liable to have a loose tongue around a woman that just kind of smiles and nods and can't understand a thing he says versus someone who actually can't understand? I don't see evidence that Torunaga knows. And if he does know, he's just a devil. I mean, he's just...
I think that's what it is. Yeah. I think he's forcing them into a situation to deal with this so that they can't just continue this arguing and sniping. And he wants this dealt with, like, one way or another.
Also, I don't think Torunaga understands women because, like, Mariko like kind of makes an obvious... observation about her plight in the society, and it's like some, like, blown, you know, it blows him away, like an Einstein level insight into so like, he also, this could be seeing as putting Mariko in as her place, like, I want you to be there, I want you to see the Anjin fuck this courtesan, and, like, if there's any tension between you, this is going to quash it, you know.
Yeah, that's how I felt. It's like, yeah, he wants,
so
he
I thought you were saying he's actually wanting them, he's like shipping them. I'm like, why the fuck would he want his... Okay, because I don't think Torunaga wants them, the couple, the pillow, or whatever.
No, I think he wants to, like, break her heart here, you know? Like, if she's got a thing for him, force her to, watch this.
He pledges to clear the Anjin's mind, knight at the best brothel with the finest courtesan.
Here's the other thing about this scene is he still thinks that the Portuguese are here for honest trade. At least that's the plain reading of this scene. He does not seem to think that the Portuguese have anything other than the best interests of both parties here at heart.
But does that... Okay, so let me ask you this. Does that jibe with your recollections of his dealings with the Portuguese in, like, the third episode? Because, like, he's horse traded with these guys.
Not really.
There's no fucking way, if he's a perceptive individual, can he think that, oh, they're just good-hearted men of Christ, you know?
Yeah, and I'm trying to... Yeah, I mean, it is specifically about the Portuguese here, and the Portuguese is who he was dealing with, the black ship captain.
Now, there could be a difference in him knowing they're up to no good and move, because, like, it seems like Torunaga's a very cautious guy. He doesn't want to make the first move. So this could just be his way of, like, deflecting, like, you know, I don't lose a battle because I don't strike first. But I have a hard time believing that he is blind to their influence.
Yeah, I do too. I feel like the proposed path forward here by Blackthorn is kind of a foolish one, right? Like, you don't want to start shit with the other two regents who are about to impeach you. Like, won't that just make them impeach him more? Like, create
it is interesting. There's two, by Torunaga's math, there's two Christian, two non-Christian lords, and I wonder if there's like some kind of like potential for action, for like, okay, if things get to this far along, I'm going to cast in with the Christians, and I've got this card to play, this card to play, this card to play. If things go the other way, I'm going to throw in with like Sugiyama and the Shido. But like, it's clear he's continuing to try to defy. And I also wonder what the balance of power is now. I guess Lord Ito doesn't seem like he's very Christian. He seems like I assume he's a pretty traditionalist Japanese man.
I don't really know.
But that's the thing. It's
him.
It seems like Kiyama and Ono and the others are just captured. They're stuck. Like, Ishido just moved against them. They can't do anything about it. So it's like, it's not what they think is best. It's just a rubber stamp. So, I can't wait to talk about that scene. We're getting closer. Asaka is burning, surprisingly enough, down to their pigeons. Shido has moved to take the other regions hostage to force their vote against Lord Torunaga. Lord T's man, the Iron Fist, cuts his way out of the castle to warn his lord. It's a pretty brief scene.
He leaves his family behind in order to.
It's Torunaga's pregnant consort, correct? That's like, this is Torunaga's wife and pregnant consort, I believe. So,
I think so. I don't know. They're such minor characters that I haven't really mapped them yet, but.
And when she tries to get on a horse, it's just like, you know, swinging those legs that far open. It feels like the baby's got to come out like a log flume. So the women are the ones that urge, like, hey, you got to leave us. We can't. You're not going to get out.
Sacrifice. I mean, and they're going to be hostages as much as anybody in this city.
Hostages, or they might just be executed. We're at that point. Shido didn't take I guess that's because of the banditry, right? There couldn't be any survivors, but
yeah, I think they're pawns that are could still be valuable. I don't know why you kill them. You hold
it,
them.
I tell you what, it is a hell of a chip for Crimson Sky. If you've got I mean, it's really like what's Lord Torunaga gonna think about? Oh my god, my wife and my consort pregnant with my child. Ishido's got me by the short curlies here.
I wonder if that's part of the message to his half-brother to spirit them away.
Yeah. Perhaps. Very curious about this half-brother.
Yeah, me too.
Is he more Torunaga or less? I don't know.
Or Yabushige. I don't know.
I kind of hope for more Yabushige. I could use another Yabushige. I want to see that Yabushige's half-brother. He's the disreputable one.
Yeah.
Can you imagine what hell on wheels that would be?
This is a huge scene, though. I mean, you know, it's short, but it's a massive shift in the status quo, I guess. Like, this is the scene that says, fuck all the norms, fuck all the protocols. We are taking this to violence. We don't care about your votes. We don't care about any of that stuff. Or public perception, although they are going to keep, you know, their flimsy ass cover story.
Oh, there is there's an attack on the air. Yeah.
Sure, justify it with fear, like rulers who want their own way always do. This is a huge shift, and it just kind of happens out of nowhere in the middle of the night.
And it also tells us the soft power Lady Ochiba has, because this is why it's happening. Yes. Like, Ishido would have been content to, well, you know, there's another hiccup and we'll get him eventually. And only Ochiba, I think, appreciates Torunaga for the threat that he could be.
Yep.
But I also don't know if her reasons are valid. We'll be getting into that. There's another brief scene of the Portuguese discussing the threat of Torunaga. Father Martin urges the Father Superior. I forget what is the Father Visitor, the head Catholic in Osaka here. He urges an alliance with Torunaga. Right. The one with the bigger hat and the frillier collar.
Yeah, it's interesting because that frilly collar guy seems to think that Torunaga might make it out the other side of this, because he's saying, I'm hoping we can turn Torunaga to our side once this is over.
So I don't, this is the one scene I don't fully understand, that my prejudice before the scene was that the Portuguese were broadly in support of the council and with the Christian lords and were opposed to Torunaga and his bullshit.
I thought so too.
But the Father Superior, the way he says, what, this Minnow Warren? Like, I wonder if you're supposed to understand that he just hasn't bothered to learn Japanese culture, or he sees Minnow Warren as like some kind of slur, when it's like saying you've got the blood of King Arthur, like, coursing through, like, you know, like, you hear Ishido come. I wonder if he's heard that as always a pejorative because the other lords are jealous of Torunaga. Because, like, that seemed like a non sequitur.
No, it seemed like he was agreeing with Martin that we need to get this guy on our side because he's a Minowara. He's an important figure. And then he says, you know, maybe we'll get him on our side when the war's over. But, like,
But it doesn't seem like a priority to him. I wasn't. And the big thing is that Father Martin's reminding us and the Father Superior here that Lady Ochiba to her bones hates Catholics, hates Christianity. Like we saw at the Tycho's funeral, she said, take your last rites and shove them up your ass, essentially. And she said that to not just a Catholic priest, but to Kiama, one of the Lord Regents, too. So her heart is really set against the religion. And I think the Portuguese, if nothing else, see that, see the truth of that.
Yeah. We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause. And now, back with more Bald Move.
So, Ochiba, we finally get to see the assault on the heir. It's the assault on the heir's heir. As she braids the shit out of his ponytail, she
is that the assault?
Boy,
too tight?
Tough crowd, yeah. He's got sensitive scalp, you know?
okay.
The girls in the audience know. You know, your mom's brushing your hair. That's just like, you know, you got a rat's nest in there. She's working it out. It's not a fun experience.
No. Some gum in there.
As she's working out the rats, she reflects back on her difficult childhood. And the backdrop is, and then after she braids her son's hair, the lords and ladies of Osaka are treated to a Japanese play about the former Taiko, defeating a treacherous samurai and fathering a child with Ochiba.
Yeah, this scene is a little confusing for me. I think I ultimately got it. Like, her father died.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that's connected to why she hates Torunaga.
No,
she
it
hates
is.
Torunaga about the Taiko stuff. Okay, so her father was killed by Mariko's
Torunaga's
father.
Man. Yeah, yeah.
And she thinks that he planned that whole thing behind the scenes. And that,
now I don't.
Jinsai was just like the execution guy.
I don't know if she came up with that theory on her own recognizance, or it's something that was like whispered to her later, or something that she's appreciated as she's become older. But it seems like that is also the rift, like that her and Mariko were best friends. Her father's murdered and the whole house is falling and she's spirited away at the last minute and told essentially never to come back because you'll probably be killed. And that's that the exact same time Mariko loses track of her.
Her father is not the leader of Japan. He's
Kuroda. I don't think he's a shogun. He's described in on the series webpage as a warlord, the warlord ruling Japan before the Taiko. But I'm not sure why the Taiko wasn't considered a shogun. Like, I'm not sure the difference between shogun versus Taiko.
Yeah,
if there were like other minor lords to other regions, like that, maybe Okinawa was its own thing. You know, still, you always have the imperial family, but they're just a ceremonial kind of figure at this point. So I'm not sure why the Taiko, because like it seems like the Taiko and shogun are almost the exact same thing in terms of like power
singular
and rank.
Rulers of the
entire country. Shogun. Its title has more to do with like anti-barbarian forces, which is maybe ironic with Blackthorn, but yeah, I don't know.
Okay, so yeah, he was the ruler and he died, and she thinks that Torunaga had a hand in that.
I wonder if the Taiko had a hand in it, because we know the Taiko and Torunaga are pretty tight. I wonder if they all kind of like, you know... We all like this we love a lot this Kuroda guy, but he's pretty brutal. Killed a lot of monks. Really, really unpopular with people. For the good of the realm, when they draw straws, I don't know.
Maybe.
I wonder if... Huh. Yeah, I wonder if that's one of the things that is, like, it is a cover-up. Like, the Taiko put him up to it, and that's, like, a secret that Torunaga and his men are keeping. That this was, like, this was a task to them. To do.
It's possible. Yeah, we just don't know yet.
And you can imagine, like, if Ochiba find out what kind of shit show that would be. Here's this young girl, you know, forced to bear the Lord's heir.
Well, the one thing they do tell us well enough to think that it's true is that Torunaga knew that this Jinsai guy, Mariko's dad, was extremely angry at this Kuroda guy, at Achiba's dad, and wanted probably to kill him at certain points.
Well, I'll go further and say that Toranaga's knowing his plan for his daughter proves a conspiracy right there. Isekai had a secret plan. Toranaga was brought into it.
I suppose.
Like, there's no possible... I mean, that's the conspiracy's right there. Because, like,
the fact
I don't think
he didn't object to it and say, what are you doing wasting your daughter's marriage?
Well, not only that, but, like, Isekai, like, when did he tell him this? After he killed his entire family and seppuku'd himself? Like, he must have told him this before he went on the mission to kill... Because I don't think he got away. Like, obviously, I think he was captured in the assassination... And, like, when would he have a chance to tell Toranaga, oh, hey, by the way, I've got the secret plan for my daughter. I need you to keep a watch after her, all that kind of, like, this had to all be laid out in aforetime.
Yeah. No, that makes sense.
I mean, I guess you could defeat me if there's a simple scene of, like, Isekai being held. Is that his name, Isekai? It's Mariko's father. Being held in a prison and Toranaga visiting him on the eve of his assassination, he lays it all. But, like, I think this is almost certainly evidence that there was a conspiracy and Toranaga was aware of it, whether he planned it, whether he just allowed it. But either way, if I'm Lady Ochiba, I'm not sure how much distinction there is between those two.
Yeah, I don't know if they're going with this in the show, but I thought from an email last week that there was some period of time where Jinsei had gotten away, had committed the murder and gotten away, and his family was taken hostage and he was captured and forced to kill, to watch them killed, or killed
himself.
I can't remember.
I will freely admit,
so
I don't
maybe,
know the time.
I don't think,
it's,
I think
it's,
you're right.
It's possible. But like I said, I'm leaning towards there was a conspiracy and a Toranaga, if he didn't plan it, he knew of it.
Yeah. And then the question becomes, why did he go along with it? It seems like there was something, you know, where he's killing monks and, like, there's some sin that the ruler committed there, that Ochiba's father committed.
He was just like a mad king. He was just brutal.
Yeah. That's like based on the email last week. That seems like
spilled too much blood. Yeah. There's a lot of fascinating things going on here. There's a conversation between Sugiyama and Kiyama that borders on treason. Yeah.
I don't know who's dumber here. Because Kiyama doesn't seem very smart. He's just like, oh, we can wait this whole thing out and we'll become free men again once, I don't know, Toranaga is dealt with. But, like, Sugiyama's right. They're hostages forever. They're never going to be allowed to rule in the way that they were before, to make actual decisions. So
even
if
he never
takes
them hostage
again,
the fact that he did and you just meekly went along with it means he could at any time. And what would you do? The same thing he did last time.
Right.
Sit and spin.
Right. Yeah. And then also Sugiyama ends up dead in this episode for resisting that. So, like, they're
both... I hesitate to say Kiyama's the dumb one when he's got his brain attached to his body, but...
But he also doesn't seem to be planning anything, right? Like, Sugiyama could have handled this so much better. He could have done...
Yeah, he's
a little bit more maneuvering, got himself away from the castle before he makes this declaration, before he reveals all his cards. Like, yeah,
he's
definitely
Ned Starking it. Yeah,
totally.
Just, I'm the one serving the realm. I'm the one that's righteous, and that righteousness will protect me like a cloak.
Yeah, so one doesn't see the situation they're in and so survives, and the other sees it and dies. And so I don't know who's the dumber here. Sugiyama seems like he understood at least what was going on.
Did you notice Ishido making eyes at Ochiba? Is he impressed with more than just her keen political mind? Is there an attraction here? Or like, this is like almost an Oedipus complex? Like, this is daddy's mommy and I kind of want to be her daddy?
Maybe.
I don't know what the...
really taking note.
I don't know where the honor and respect lies on that. Of like, that would be prestigious if he could wed the consort of the Taiko, if he could become Shogun himself. That's what he wants. But I did catch that, like, the widow of the Taiko that's now a nun, she sees all this, kind of rolls her eyes, and she doesn't think much of Ishido. She says that he's nothing more than my husband's favored Kosho, which I had a bit of a problem looking up, because nowadays it's almost always paired with another Japanese word that turns it into black pepper. A Kosho is essentially an attendant of a noble person, and it's kind of the same as like a page or a squire to a medieval knight. You know, someone, a young man who's assigned to a lord that's supposed to know, that's supposed to learn like Bushido and martial warfare from him, that's also supposed to like carry notes between him and the other lords, act as a secretary or scribe. It's a prestigious position, but depending on which lord you serve, you might not have seen as much action. It seems that the old Taiko's wife doesn't see Ishido as anything more than that paper pusher, that page. And he says the way she describes him as good but never great is, and she's like, you're picking the wrong horse. You should you should saddle up Lord T.
Yeah. That's interesting. She can't do it though, right? We'll see here in a couple scenes. She just really hates Tornaga.
Yeah, let's go ahead and talk, because I just figured we'd continue to discuss the scene. That triggers a flashback to Oshiba remembering an earlier conversation with the Taiko's wife, where she's being recruited with what I can only describe as an army of wombs to attempt to bear the Taiko a male heir.
Yeah.
And she says, she tells Oshiba to buck her up. A woman may lose everything she has, but she must also take it back. She must stare without fear into the cruel eyes of fate and make herself seen.
Yep.
And she'll, they don't
say that to Shido at one at some point later,
with a little bit more of a badass twerk put on it. But they don't really, like, it's obvious that in by 2024 standards, that the Taiko is just repeatedly raping this young woman. It's obvious that she's being drugged. She alludes to other unpleasant things. I don't know if she's referring to some kind of quack Japanese medicine, some kind of procedure she had to go through.
Examinations of her intimate body parts. Like, there's
and
probably
just
a
being
lot
drugged
of just, like,
and raped on a nightly basis is probably enough to that seems pretty rough. Did you have the same thought when you found out that there was hundreds of women that tried to give the Taiko heir that I did?
I thought he was just impotent.
Right. Which naturally means that his heir...
Sure. Shouldn't exist, but he does. So who gave her that son? Sure.
Yeah. Like what kind of fucking plot was this? I mean, it's like, and people are, oh, you're jumping to conclusion. No fucking shot. No fucking shot. When you hear someone in antiquity plowing through tons of wives and concubines, just can't find an heir, can't find an heir, can't find an heir. It's not the women that's the problem, man. The Lord's shooting blanks, but no one's allowed to say that. No one's allowed to say, your penis is broke, Lord.
Sure.
So they just keep cycling through the women, and people find a way to make do. So I wonder...
There are two options. There's one that he could just not... he never got excited enough, right? I go back to the like blue-eyed samurai... show, and there was a really disgusting dude in there who he had that problem, right? Just nothing excited him enough to get him going to climax. So like,
I didn't get that from the Taiko. He seemed
either.
Almost lecherous, like hungry when he saw her.
No, I think it's the latter. It's he is impotent, so
Does this explain the eyes between him and Oshiba? Did maybe Ishido, the favored squire, get the old nod? I don't know.
Maybe.
But I am Matt. And then the other question is, the other thing is, like, does Tornada know this? Because I can't believe he would take such a shine to the boy and be so outwardly willing to defend him if he thought he was a bastard.
Yeah. Maybe it's Toranaga's child. And that's why he takes such a shine.
Why would Oshiba hate him so? Oh, because of the father thing. I guess that would be a cruel... Well, but this all happened before she had the child.
Yeah, I don't know. It's kind of a wild...
That would be... Hypothesis. I tell you what, that would be wild if she was forced to sleep with him, the father to child, because I don't think she'd do it willingly, because at this point, I think she'd already suspected... But maybe not. Yeah. Like, again, the timeline's fuzzy. That's one of the interesting things about kind of be finding this stuff out slow. You don't really know.
Yeah, and then you got to wonder, like, was it desperation? Was she ordered to maybe sleep with somebody else in secret by the Tycho, who was unwilling to die without an heir?
Being like, look, honey, I'm running out of heirloom mirrors. We gotta make it work with you, or I got nothing.
Yeah, or maybe he did it because he didn't want to die without an heir. I don't know. More on that, I'm sure.
Afterwards, we meet Lord Ito, who is the lead actor in this production, and he's recruited by Ishido to be the fifth member of the council, enlisting his support to impeach Toranaga. Are we supposed to draw like is this like a supposed to be like a Ronald Reagan type thing, where it's like this is an actor who is getting into politics, and I mean, shit, Ronald Reagan became the leader of the free world, so maybe not count Lord Ito out, but like whenever I see a guy, like this guy didn't seem like he was into politics. This guy seems like a weak dude that's open to flattery, that might have a relationship of some sort with Ochiba, respect her, and they just know he's just a puppet. He's literally a puppet. You know, he plays a lord and is good at it, and that's what they want him to do.
Yep. No, that makes sense. I gotta say, I'm hypnotized, mesmerized by this no stuff. It's so weird. I absolutely love the warbly singing that happens. It gives it a otherworldly quality, and
that's
it seems
the word
like
for it.
There are multiple people singing at the same time in a lot of these instances, kind of creating these strange harmonics. I don't know. I think it's hypnotizing when you're watching it.
And this is like the super slow, like metronome that kind of like times everything with that, those little, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was weird that like when he starts singing the Lady Ochiba, I'm like, oh my god, he's like doing an address, but it's actually we're watching Lady Ochiba's story.
Yeah.
And it's funny because like, you can see the young heir, he's kind of in between, and he's kind of like looks like he's yawning, getting bored. But I was like, that must be wild to see a play about your own conception. There's also a brief scene of Ishido thanking Lady Ochiba for the suggestion of Lord Ito, and that they both kind of wax poetic about the Taiko, and she used this opportunity to kind of goad him a little bit. So that brings us to the next day. Blackthorn sees the Iron Fist, who has rode his horse to the verge of collapse. He himself collapses as he gets to the village, and Lord Toranaga, in response, calls a war council to debate their next course of action. We ready to talk about Operation Crimson Sky, Jim?
Crimson Sky. Red, blood red sky.
Badass, man. Crimson Sky.
The sounds
world,
severe.
The world... World's falling down on you, Ishido.
Yeah, pretty severe. It's a direct attack on Osaka Castle. Go and you kill the council, you take over the government and form a new one with Toranaga Shogun.
The violent boner that Toranaga's son, Nagakato, and Omi get when they mention this, like the idea these young guys have never seen war, the glory. And with the Nagakato especially, it's like, yes, father, take your, become the shogun that we know you were meant to be. And Toranaga's like, no, but it's bullshit. No, I can't, we can't do this. But he doesn't have another option because he knows what's going to happen. As soon as they get this fifth regent appointed, they're going to falsely impeach him, demand him to give himself up and kill him. And then it's over. So like, and I wonder if there is like some kind of sociological thing that we're missing. Like, Toranaga knows, like, well, if they actually give me a lawful order to kill myself, I'll have to do it. But if I can rebel before then and put an end to it, is there like a window of time where like you just can't respectably do a coup and get the legitimacy from the people? Because it seems like what you could do is they call for your head, you call your banners, you go kick their ass in, take down the government, replace it with you, and then boom, you're done. But
I don't know. And whatever excuse you want to come up with to justify that is just as substantial an excuse, in my opinion, as, a threat to the heir. mysterious.
It's
like,
also maybe a change of posture here that's hinted that, like, because it seemed like last episode, Tornaga was willing to let them come to him. I've got all my men here. We're on this peninsula. It's mountainous. It's well guarded. We are going to slaughter those fools as they try to get through. Whereas now, well, maybe with the loss of the men, he's like, ooh, the balance of power is different, and he can't do that.
Mm-hmm. I think so.
Okay. I thought so. Omi's given a chance to, like, distinguish himself, and this is the first time I've ever seen him kind of demure. He doesn't really anything but restate what's already been said. No, you thought he did have a little bit of a...
I mean,
feather?
So everybody here is gung-ho about let's go in and let's do Crimson Sky, and Omi's the one who suggests, well, maybe we wait a little bit, you know, because Crimson Sky's crazy. And ultimately, Tornaga agrees, I can't do Crimson Sky.
Yeah.
Well, he temporarily agrees anyway.
His son says, but father, you've never lost a battle. It's because I haven't started one.
Yeah.
You ever read Sun Tzu?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And he insists
so
again that he will never seek to be shogun. He has never sought and never will seek to be shogun.
I think we can put aside the Japanese no and study the art of the English playwright Shakespeare. I think the Lord doth protest too much. This is a much better version of what Yabushiga was doing during the Cannon incident, I think.
Sure. Yeah.
But also, right. I do think it seems like a fairly foolhardy. That seems that with his present disposition of forces, it also does seem like a kind of foolhardy plan.
Oh yeah, I don't see that there's much opportunity there. I don't know. They introduced this guy Seiki Nobutatsu, who is Tornaga's half brother, might be willing to help him, and he's in Osaka, right?
Yeah, I think so. That he could essentially give them, maybe let them in, somehow reposition guards or leave a door unlocked or something along those lines. Having an inside man. Yeah.
Or even be there to turn on them from the inside when they realize Tornaga's there.
Make it a two-front war in your own city.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't understand Yabushiga's observation that attacking Osaka is like strangling your own neck. What the fuck is he talking about?
Suicide. Like, that's a frontal attack is just... That's
I thought he was trying to say something about the political situation. Like, neck is the only one not in that. But he's saying he's like, literally, it's suicide. Okay.
Yeah, this is a suicide run. There's no way we can win that battle.
Yeah, that seems...
And that's when they introduced the half-brother to maybe help them.
Yeah. So anyway, Mariko and Fuji, meanwhile, negotiate with Madame Jin, who is the headmistress of the most prestigious brothel in all of Izu, for the services of Kiku, the all-star courtesan, which we also know as Omi's girlfriend.
And we all knew, when they said, yes, get him the best courtesan, we all knew it was going to be Kiku. We've seen her at work, and she seems to really zero in on what people want.
Plus, there's a lot of good-looking ladies in the show, but she is, like, clearly some top-shelf stuff. Like, just the way she's beautiful, the way she moves, how keenly insightful she is at seeing people's greatest desires and what they really want. Like, you can see why she's worth 30 manmi or whatever, or 300 rather, probably 500. But
I love this scene, this negotiation.
Dude, I have been a Yabushiga stan since he boiled. I mean, no, that's not what made him, but like since he swaggered onto the scene, I think this guy is great. He's super entertaining. He's evil as fuck, and you can't trust him, but he's goddamn fun to watch. I think this episode, Fuji stole my heart. Her side eye and tea sips in this scene had me rolling on the floor.
Okay.
That like, Lady Jin observing, like, oh, the engine's never not in your presence. And, like, Fuji just, like, takes that sup with the cup with the big eyes and, like, I'm just sipping my tea here.
Yeah,
she's really stealing all the scenes, man.
Yeah, she's great. I like this negotiation, the back and forth of like, well, you know, she asks for just what I come to understand through context is an absurd amount, these 500 whatever they're called. Mm-hmm. And Mariko pushes back with the phrase, I misspoke. I didn't mean to convey that I was looking to rent every girl in the entire nation of Japan, or whatever she said.
I didn't want to buy every brothel in Izo. I just wanted one lady for the night.
Right.
So the way she says it reminds me so much of like Oren Ishii in like Kill Bill, dealing with her, you know, the Japanese Yakuza lords, where she's like ultra polite but also extremely disrespectful. Like, and it's a little bit of the Iron Fist too, where he was talking with the Yabushiga's like, oh, so sorry. I thought, like, there's this very veneer of politeness, but I'm going to cut you. Or, you know, I'm going to throw you out of my house unless you start talking sense.
No, that's great. And here's the thing. I had spoken in previous episodes about how good Mariko's poker face is.
Mm-hmm.
She was really nailing it. This episode, that crumbles. There is no poker face. She's lost it all. I mean, even this person who has, you know, rumors are flying apparently about her and Blackthorn. People are talking. She's hearing him. And she uses that to extract, you know, another 100 whatevers from the lore here. And then in the next scene, we'll see with where we actually get to Kiku. It's pretty apparent their feelings for each other to anybody who's in the room with him.
I also really appreciated how maybe I'm reading into this too much, but I thought that with the ladies picking up the cups and setting them down, there's a slight percussion every single time they did, that this was like a mirror of the no scene before. It kind of gives it a little bit of like a drama back of the haggling, because they're both like Fuji opens up with like, oh, you think it's a pretty cup? Ah, well, you know, all of our really good ones were destroyed in the earthquake. And the madam's like, I know, poor lady Kiku, she's lost all her dresses. Oh, she's going to have to save up to buy more. They're just like back and forth trying to, you know, work each other down on the price. Mm-hmm. And this is like kind of duel. And that's the thing, is like, Lady Jin, she knows that Mariko wants to be with him alone, and she's essentially off. That's what's being offered here. Like, Kiku can step aside.
This is the Willow world is what she's offering, and in my interpretation of this, I don't know anything about willows or lilies or lakes for that matter,
much less the world.
But I do know the one thing I do know is that the willows are kind of around the edges of the lake. The women are like the lilies. The willows are sort of guarding them. The willows are hiding, obscuring the lake and the lilies a little bit.
Yeah, they get those low branches that go almost all the way to the ground. It's hard to see what's going on underneath the trunk.
So the willow world here is that veil that they provide, that privacy. And so inside the willow world here, she can, you know, act out the things that she's clearly feeling. That's what the extra 100 here is about.
Mm-hmm. It's for discretion.
Uh-huh.
So there's a brief scene of Kiku telling Omi about how this is such a huge opportunity, serving Lord Torunaga this way, to become the most celebrated courtesan in all of Kanto, the Kanto region.
Yeah.
Which doesn't impress him. In fact,
no.
Her fucking this barbarian might be the end of her and Omi, seems like.
Yeah, he's taking it pretty hard.
All right, then we go to Mariko and Blackthorn later that night, making a visit to the Willow World, where they have a profound experience.
Yeah, and this Willow World is, you know, not just about giving people physical pleasure, although it is that, but it's really about taking their mind off of transcending the things that are weighing on them emotionally, and giving them the space to do that.
Yeah.
And Kiku really shepherding shows off them through that.
Yeah, like trying to create a permission structure. Like you can see her kind of playing coy about it, and she's pouring a sake and she's getting them talking. But then the way she directly addresses Mariko is like, a woman cannot stand by to see another woman in pain. And the way she like puts herself behind Mariko and is talking to Blackthorn, but clearly it's intending to channel her voice through Mariko.
Yeah, because otherwise Blackthorn would be looking at Kiku this whole time, right? She's sitting across from him, and these words won't feel like they're coming from Mariko. I really like that.
And even though Mariko, you think she's got, like, I think seven of her eightfold fences got torn down by this approach. Like, there's this one paper wall keeping this throbbing need from breaking out. But, like, it's you know, you can see Blackthorn being affected when she's like, cast your eyes on what you desire, my body. And he's just looking at Mariko and she's like, you know, just scan her up and down. And Mariko's getting caught up.
It's interesting sort of how they make them think of different things, because Mariko here thinks of her father
and the relief, and that's the safety, the sanctuary.
That's interesting. I don't know
that this is a place she could forget, the perfect moment they could have it in, and completely But and then she makes a I invite you into my openness. Jesus Christ. Whew. Shades of what's that first thing time we saw Christina Hendricks in Firefly, you know, her quote in Scripture to Mal. This is some kind of invitation, and I think she's genuinely disappointed, and so is John when Mariko says, nope, it must be only you. There's this very meaningful pass as he goes into the inner quarters. They touch hands. People already fucked, but they're holding hands is getting their motors racing.
I mean, they went to 100 and then back to 0, so now that they're at what, 10 here.
And there's like a lot of meaningful looks exchanged, which brings us to the next day. The Anjin is walking down the path from the tea house to the outskirts of the village, where he finds this apparently strained relationship with him and Mariko and plenty of jealous onlookers.
Yeah, so that's kind of what I was trying to decipher here. Is this customary when you hire a courtesan of this stature, the skill level and expense, that you would want to be seen with them coming out of this brothel? Or is this something they're doing simply because, I don't know, he's who he is. He's the Hatamoto.
I think it's the fascination of the barbarian and him having sex with a Japanese woman, and not just any Japanese woman. And I also, you wonder if the villagers know about Omi and her and how much time they spend together. It feels like they probably would.
Yeah.
So there's also that kind of like,
I mean, if there
whisper,
are rumors
whisper,
about
gossip.
Blackthorn and Mariko, there'd probably be rumors about Omi and Kiku.
You also see the translation, the very, very bare bones translation that Mariko's providing, you know, where Blackthorn's using a lot more flowery language, and he's like, he thanks you for your service. And she's like, oh, yeah, you should come back anytime. I want to count the moments. She is honored. You know, she's like over this bullshit.
There was some of that in the previous scene, too, where I thought Mariko might be intentionally mistranslating, because he's complimenting her. He's like, our prostitutes are nowhere near this beautiful or inquisitive. And she's like, she essentially translates that as, I prefer my homeland.
The
opposite in spirit, in my opinion.
No, yeah. No, she was definitely, again, I don't know if I could describe this duty as leal, but she's trying to drive, she's trying to thread the needle between her duty and her desires, I guess. Aren't we all? So Lord Torunaga discusses Mariko's past and future with her. The revelations he drops on her rock her to her core. This is a great scene that shows how much Torunaga respects her.
Yeah. And I can't tell if that's a misplaced respect in light of the fact that she didn't understand her father's true meaning about, you know, the duty. If Torunaga's suddenly like, oh, I thought she was persevering all this time because she knew what her father wanted her to do and like was waiting for the right time.
I wish I knew what her father expected her to do. Did she? Did he expect her to grab that Nagatata and avenge him at some point?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, clearly she was training as a warrior, so she might have been capable of it.
And who would she get avenged? Because he killed the evil guy. Like, is he going to have her kill the? Like, who needs to die? The Taiko?
Maybe.
Would Torunaga be cool with that?
Is she supposed to kill the Taiko's heir now? Like,
I don't, yeah, like, that's the thing. It's like, I don't, where is the grudge? Like, I can see why Uchiba would hate Mariko because of the father thing, but unless there's some secret grudge against Taiko, or I guess the other thing, now that I'm thinking about it, is if Torunaga and, no, that can't be, because I'm like, if Torunaga and Isekai, or Mariko's dad, that might not be his name, if they both knew, they can't have known that the heir was illegitimate, because this happened a long time before that, right?
Yes,
because she was married after the death. So yeah, I honestly don't understand, like, why. I can understand, like, it maybe why Torunaga thought she knew that she had a greater purpose because the Eightfold Fence bullshit and the whole, like, well, we don't tell Fuji her swords are fake because she, like, maybe it would be seen as distasteful to constantly remind her of her duty or whatever. But, like,
sure.
It seems wild that no one thought to ever discuss this with her. You know, like, I can't believe that 15 years later, you didn't know you're on a secret sleeper cell mission from your father. But Torunaga being straight with her. This could be the deal that he was supposed to tell her that, but he just kept her in his back pocket, you know, roiling in resentment and bitterness, you know, essentially making her more and more angry and willing to do things for him. But, like, I just don't see, like, what role she's going to play.
Yeah. I don't know. But her duty was, you know, to stay married to Buntaro, far from the action, far from the fray, so that she could one day, I don't know, avenge him.
Yeah.
Or help Torunaga succeed in the plan that they are still carrying out. That seems more like what it is. Because, like, he would never assign her to avenge him because he's not dead when he marries her off, right? So it's more about the long term.
Yeah, and I do think it's interesting that they make a distinction between, looks like Lady Mariko was trained in the arts of the female warrior, the woman warrior, and it doesn't seem Uchiba was, because she was always shown as, like, off to the side with the royal court watching Mariko kind of exercise and work out and practice her kata. But so I wonder if, like, literally she's going to duel Lady Uchiba to the death or run her through or something. But that's like, why... Yeah, I don't know.
Is it a fight against Christianity? Like a longer term keeping Japan from falling into the clutches?
That's something we don't still appreciate. Why did Mariko turn to Christianity in her grief? And, you know, the idea that my life is shit,
really
it's become shit, everything's been taken from me, I'm just living for the next world now. We still haven't seen her conversion, because I don't think she started as a little girl as a priest or as a Christian.
Yeah, I don't think so.
If you are right about those monks converting to Christianity, and that's why Kuroda killed, maybe that would explain that she, maybe her father did convert, was soft on Christianity or something. Like I said, that's not what I thought about that, but, like,
I'm just thinking of the long-term stuff. Like, what could he have done before he was, you know, killing? I mean, he preemptively got her out of the way because he knew he was going to kill this guy.
Yeah. That's the thing, but is, like, I don't think it was that far future planning, but...
But I do think, like, Torunaga knew about it. It was part of a plan. What could that be that Torunaga would still be carrying out? Because everybody involved in it's dead.
Yeah. Especially also that, like, why... Why wouldn't Torunaga say something like, Mariko, aren't you supposed to be doing something? Like, has everyone just been waiting for Mariko to take a move? Or is it, like, something's supposed to go... I'll say this... If we don't know the broad strokes of her mission by the end of next episode, I'm going to be a little frustrated. Because to me, this was
there's
a big reveal that, and then we have a moment, we end with a moment of awesome, but, like, I need Mariko to reflect and maybe talk with Fuji or somebody. I need more information. It's like, we only got 4 more episodes to go, and I don't have... hardly any of Torunaga's true motivations, and I still don't feel like I peeled that back the inmost heart on the Mariko yet either. I kind of need to know that to get invested. So,
yeah, and finding out that Mariko had never understood her true purpose here has sort of renewed Torunaga's will to finish this fight, right?
Yeah, because she feels like a failed, and, you know, Torunaga looks thoughtful about this and says, "No, your war's not over." So, but this is another great piece of dialogue about, you know, Torunaga not So this is the other thing. If Torunaga was complicit with his vassal's treachery, quote unquote, why would he not know why Lady Ochiba hates him? He seems to be genuinely bewildered. Like, why is she, you know, what everyone kind of wonders, why could have turned her into this woman? And
yeah, and it can't have to do with Christianity, because she also hates the Christians. So like,
right. And yeah. And he observes, like, you know, yeah, we all have things we got to war against, but most find a way to do it with honor. And she kind of smirks and says, well, that's a man talking, because you guys can go to war for conquest. You can go to war for respect or for power. Us women are just at war, you know. I thought that was an interesting juxtaposition that, like, yeah, look, Lady Ochiba felt like she's been at war for her entire life and sees, like, the Ishido's passiveness as a weakness. She wants to get back to it. But yeah. So back in Osaka, Ishido introduces Lord Ito, the actor, to the council, but Sugiyama refuses to go along with the puppetry any longer. Ochiba is impatient to see Torunaga fall, so she pressures Ishido into action, which leads to Sugiyama attempting to escape Osaka Castle with his family, but they're murdered by quote-unquote bandits.
It's bandits. It's always bandits.
It's always bandits.
Yep.
It looks like, the Christian lords are ready to fall in line. It's just Sugiyama saying, nope, I gotta be the one that stands for the realm. And you're dishonoring the Taiko's wishes, and Ishido takes more and more offense until he finally says, fuck all y'all, I'm the only real one among you, and he takes off.
Yeah, it kind of makes sense that this would be the guy, right? I mean, his family has been historically extremely wealthy and powerful, and he's actively losing all that. He's going to become a puppet, he realizes it, and that, I think he's bristling against that more than anything.
Rather die in his feet than attached to strings to Ishido, who's attached to strings by Ochiba.
he's just really clumsy in his dealing with it, I guess. You know,
as the season's gone on, I don't dislike Ishido, but it does seem like he is definitely the bureaucrat. He is content to shuffle a few more papers rather than pick up a sword to do something, and only Lady Ochiba just puffing him up, you know, insulting his manhood. Say, like, why should I, you know, she tells a story about how she suspects Torunaga of this treachery, and he's like, oh, just go public that story, and he'll just down, he's like, why would I bother? You all are impotent. You can't stop him. And then she does this kind of seductive thing where she sits beside him and whispers in his ear, do you know how I became the heir's mother? I compelled fate to look at me and I scratched out its eyes. Yeah. Badass.
Yep.
By the way, the guy I've been calling Isekai apparently is a catchy.
Yeah, I put his name here too.
The fuck? Go and edit all your memories of me being wrong. But that's the thing. It's like she says that her hatred of Torunaga began in her childhood, like when she was hanging out at Mariko. All those years I watched him whispering and plotting. Is it possible that she's meant, like, is like she like suffering from 16th century like schizophrenia? Like she's got some kind of like paranoid delusion that, and she's seen Torunaga's leal service to the realm as like treachery, or is she so invested in her father not being a bad man, and he died when she was very young that she just can't see that her father was an evil man?
I hope it's the latter. I kind of hate stories that try and introduce like a chemical thing. It's much more interesting. It's much more dramatic when characters are just wrong about their assessment of the situation.
That's true.
That creates more drama to me. Not somebody being literally psychotic and they can't tell reality from fiction. That could be interesting in the right story. I've seen that in Mr. Robot. That's kind of cool. But like in this, no. I absolutely don't want to see that in this.
I do think it's sometimes interesting to see like how mental illness was portrayed in like, you know, ancient times where people didn't understand it. It's like, oh, he's just got visions or prophet or God speaking through him. No, he's this dude's off, you know, he's got brain chemistry imbalance.
Sure.
But yeah. I agree, in a show like this, like you can have crazy people, but they're not usually the interesting ones, and they're not, you know, like Joffrey was not an interesting character in Game of Thrones.
He was, I mean, he's also not,
he's only,
he's
interesting
not psychotic,
in what,
right, he's not,
and what effect
he
had.
Is, but like, sure.
Yeah, but yeah, he's
Tywin,
not
like a much
he's...
more interesting character, right?
Exactly.
Cersei is much more interesting.
Nothing like, he's not the fulcrum of any power that gets shifted. He's the, you know, he's the lever, maybe. He's the hatchet man, but you're right, Uchiba.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
He's
like,
unknowingly the fulcrum.
I guess if you're vengeance obsessed, I don't know if that's in the DSM-4. but she definitely has that. She's got a hate boner for Toranaga. Oh, yeah. And the other thing we haven't talked about was Sugiyama. He just, you know, tries to get his wife out in the middle of the night. Shido's way ahead of him and has him met on the road and slain.
And we've seen this battle a couple of times now, so I think it was artfully done where they're sort of having this conversation and it comes to it. The conversation's inevitable conclusion, and then we just cut to the bodies laying on the forest floor. That was well done. I mean, Crimson
so at the
Sky
end of the episode,
is on, man.
Crimson Sky. It's time
it's
for
on.
Crimson Sky to fall, to dawn. And that's where we get to Lord Toranaga sees the assassination of Sugiyama for what it is, and he rallies his troops to war. Get another rousing round of hi, hi, ho.
Mm-hmm. I'm ready.
Yeah. Yep. And I also love the reactions, like Iron Hands, like Crimson Sky, Iron Hands is like, fuck yeah. His son's like, fuck yeah.
Don't get too excited, though, because I'm pretty sure next episode we still have to build up to Crimson Sky. I don't think there's going to be any frontal attack on Osaka Castle.
I wouldn't be surprised.
I think it's going to be clearing the throat for, episode 8 to be the big attack.
Well, I tell you what, it's interesting because like he's still behind the Eightfold Fences. He's now saying that like I'm reluctantly drawn into this. I'm only doing this to defend the Tycho's heir. You know, these guys are traitors against him, and it's like someone's up to something, or this is one of the biggest tragic miscommunications in all of history. The fact that Toranaga is just innocently trying to acquire power because he suspects the other four lords are up to no good, and the other four lords see him acquiring power, But I suspect that there's something going on with the Men of War in here.
Yeah, I'm super curious because like the way that they framed it this episode, I could see Toranaga being wary of Uchiba, not the council. The council, you know, was a balance of power. That's what it was designed to be, and it was probably fairly effective at that. So he's gathering power because he knows that Uchiba hates him, and that Uchiba pulls the real strings here. And against that.
Because Shido, of course, he was, I had this theory that I was working up in real time about, like, we know that Uchiba was a guest in Toranaga's castle.
At the beginning.
The start of the series. And I'm wondering, because all the other lords thought this was a transparent attempt for Toranaga to take a hostage. I wonder if they had some kind of, like, intense back and forth where she intended... You know, she let slip that she intended to overthrow him or something, and that's what set all this in motion. And we're going to find that in a flashback but that doesn't really.
I'd say it seems like he's been building power.
That's the thing.
A while,
it's like then that he would still be building power without that provocation for a long time. But I wonder
if maybe years ago
he
found out that Uchiha hates him, right? Or assume that Uchiha hates him for killing her father. That's a pretty good assumption if she kind of found that out and he knew she found that out.
Yeah, and the other guys, it just seems like they're jealous. Like, he's got the royal blood. He's Aragorn, and you're dealing with Boromir and Faramir and Denethor, and they're all just like, fuck this king and his return. We're fine as regents, yeah. We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause. And now, back with more Bald Move.
I really want to get to the feedback because we have some discussion of this that I think is super interesting and kind of puts this all in Toranaga's lap, but I think there's still a big question mark.
Okay, well, we're done discussing the episode, so let's get to feedback. If you want to send us feedback, shogun@baldmove.com. Also, while I got your attention, don't forget that you can follow us on all social medias @baldmove. And finally, if you'd like to support us and get more bonus content, such as, again, our discussion, recent discussions of Blue-Eyed Samurai. I just had a fantastic discussion about the entirety of Three Body Problem on our Off the Clock podcast. You can find all that, plus ad-free feeds and tons of other bonus features. Support.baldmove.com if that's interesting to you. Shogun at baldmove.com, Jim.
Yeah, you want to start by reading this, I guess Father Martin wrote
Father
in.
Martin?
Yeah.
Father Martin took a time from his busy head shaving schedule and took the time to write us in saying, regarding Ishido's loyalty and Torinaga's goals, what I think the show has told us so far is that the other regents are not trying to impeach Torinaga primarily out of greed or ulterior motives. It's fear. Mother's heir appearing and being angry, partly being held hostage, seals the deal. As the show begins, we learn that Torinaga has the heir's mother essentially hostage and has been expanding his power with marriage alliances. He's also a Minowara, so he has a claim to the shogunate. If he can seize it, he'll have legitimacy, and his recent moves indicate that he has the desire to at least prepare for that possibility. So the other regents realize Torinaga is amassing power. They also know he's smart and cunning. If he reaches a certain point of relative power to the rest of them, he'll be within striking distance of the shogunate. He'll be in prime position to take advantage of any opportunities or chaos in the council. As they know, because he's so clever, that they won't see his move until it's too late, so they're trying to preemptively strike before that happens. I want to pause here. Isn't that playing into his hands? Like, has no one on the council been like, we have to stop this Torinaga before he does something, and someone says, you know, he's never lost a battle because he never started one. What if we just don't start? What if we let him start? Like,
well, then they think there's this sword of Damocles over their head, right? Like, at any moment Torinaga could make his move. I think it's fairly convincing,
but there's no evidence of him ever striking first.
Well, true.
And the Taiko is, you know, I guess he's only been dead for a year. So, like, this is all... This, the other thing is, like, keep in mind this has all happened in a relatively recent period of time. We saw the Taiko's son when he died. He isn't that much older. Mm-hmm. It's not been years he's amassing power. It's kind of been, like, of recent, so... Anyway, as to his motives, just think of it objectively. Regardless of what he says, he's a claimant to the throne, he's gathering forces, he's making moves that would give him leverage over the young heir. What does it indicate? Everyone understands that Taiko set up the Council of Regents in an attempt to maintain a balance of power to protect the heir, and Torinaga is trying to upset that balance in his favor. Seems pretty obvious to me what he's preparing for. And,
so,
you know, there's,
I like this.
There's also the Taiko giving him soul rule and him saying, well, that will just have the four... So he didn't say, I don't want that. He said, well, that will just, you know, fuck your long-term plan up. So...
And it'll put a bullseye on me personally, like, you know, he doesn't want that heat. I think this is a really convincing email as to the way that these regents see Torinaga. I think yes, they look at all the things he's doing, and they laid it out in the very first episode, right? When he meets with them for the first time, they're like, you've taken six consorts or whatever they call them, and amassed like all of this support behind you. You're unbalancing this thing, and they're right. The question is, what is the inciting act here? Is that the inciting act, that he's doing all of this consolidation of power, or is the inciting act something we haven't seen yet? Is it his fear of Lady Ochiba? Because now that the Taiko's dead, he knows the sway that Lady Ochiba would have over this council, and we see it in this episode. Like, it's never... Mm-hmm. If there was ever a doubt, now there is no doubt. And he knows that she hates him, probably for his role in her father's death, or her, at least her assumed, what she has assumed of his role in her father's death. And he knows that as soon as she gets an opportunity, she's coming at him. So it's actually a defensive move, but they read it as an offensive move.
I just came to this conclusion. I got a binary statement. One of these things has to be true. Either Mariko is completely wrong about Torinaga and the threefold heart, an eightfold fence, or Torinaga is not revealing his true intentions when he says, I don't want to be shogun, I don't want a war, I don't want to, like, one of those things has to be wrong. And I don't think it's Mariko. So now I'm like, I think I'm almost convinced that Torinaga is an ambitious little fucker. And he might have the good of the realm because he thinks Ishido is a bureaucrat and too weak to protect the heir, but he definitely wants to take it all for himself. Unless, because if not, like, if he's saying with, if he's saying his inner heart out loud to all of his men, then Mariko's wrong about the whole heart, the hidden heart thing. And if anything, we've been said that Torunaga is the most hidden of hearts because of his upbringing, being a hostage, being shuffled around the lords and having to live by his wits and not trust in loyalties. So
I need to go back and watch the way he interacts with the heir. If there is any hint of like seeding doubts about Christianity in the heir or something like that, because that would tip a little bit of a hand for me. Because ultimately where my head is right now is I'm going back to the beginning of this, where Jinsei and Torunaga haven't yet struck out against Ochiba's father, and they see something wrong that needs to change. And whether it's that this guy is a crazy murderous bastard and he just has to be put down, or whether there is some change that's happening in Japan that they need to stop, that's an open question. I don't know what that, because that to me is the inciting event, right? It's whatever caused them to want to go after Ochiba's father. And with the way he's chopping heads off monks, I feel it has to do with religion. It has to, but we'll see. All right, let's go over to Joel. Who says, so with the dinner scene, did you happen to notice that Mariko and Fuji are eating separately instead of with everyone else? Is that an interesting note about the culture here? This is one of those things that was discussed in the book that the show doesn't really talk about. The women would eat first so that during dinner, their attention could be on the husbands and make sure they had everything they needed. So are you telling me that Mariko never planned to eat any of that pheasant? She had already eaten?
Is this only for like the big state dinners? Because I thought they were having lunch and then later having dinner. And it also doesn't explain why Blackthorn was eating with the women when he ate that like fermented bean curd stuff, that sticky bean thing. So like, is that Fuji all the time it? Or?
Because like she is the actual servant here, right? I mean, Mariko's a servant in that she's a translator, but she's more like sitting down with a family meal with her husband and this Anjin. But I don't know.
Moving on to Nate says, I thought this was a phenomenal episode, and the changes from both the book and history really ratchet up the drama. Not going into detail too much on these, but I will say that Ochiba-Mariko rivalry that they've set up is new and amazing. I'm so here for it. In reality, the person Ochiba's based on was not the real Kuroda, Oda's daughter, but his niece, and there was a completely different reason in the book why Ochiba hated Torunaga. They've taken that out of the show, it seems, but by making Ochiba the daughter of the assassinated Kuroda, she's now got revenge as a reason to destroy Torunaga. This is an all-new show thing, but this is the kind of historical change for the purpose of making dramatic show I can get behind. Interesting.
That's what I'm talking about.
I don't understand why the stink from... God damn it, what's his name? The guy I've been calling Isekai the whole time.
Oh.
Akechi?
Jinsei. Yeah.
Jinsei, yeah. I don't understand how the stink from that war blew off onto Torunaga just because he's his lord.
She thought they were plotting together. That's the only thing I can think.
But like, why? Just because, again, because he's his lord?
I don't know.
Or does she have some kind of hard evidence? That's what I'm questioning.
Yeah, same here.
Also, the scenes negotiating with Jin for Kiku's adult services, absolutely killer. Loved it all, especially Fuji's expression as she took it all in. Spilling the tea, indeed. She spilt no tea, sir.
No.
She used the tea to skillfully hide her widened eyes and her Mona Lisa smile.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's such a legendary reaction gif. I feel that's one of those. It's every once in a while you see one. It's like that's going to be seen on Twitter decades from now. And if the site formerly known as Twitter is still going, I bet it does because it's so good. It's so subtle, so funny. Fuji and Yabashiga running neck and neck for my heart right now. Nice. Anything else in closing, Jim, before we let people go?
I'm super excited for next episode. I do think it's going to be a throat-clearing episode, but we'll see.
Yeah, it's also spring break this next weekend, so I'm for damn sure staying up late to watch it when it opens. I hope you join us next week, too, for the latest episode of Shogun. Shogun at baldmove.com is where you send us email. Don't forget support.baldmove.com if you would like to get more Bald Move, entirely zero ads, and extra bonus content, access to private parts of community, tons and tons of stuff. Support.baldmove.com. Thanks for listening once again. Can't wait to see you back next week. Until then, I'm your host, Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.